Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everybody, welcome into the weekend edition of the KE Report. My name is Corey Fleck and I'm your host for this first hour. We have been seeing just extreme historic moves in a wide range of markets and quite frankly in government action. So much of the world is shut down. Even back home in Vancouver, for me, BC has declared a state of emergency. Not the first time they've done this, but the last few times were due to wildfires. And quite frankly, everybody is more or less stuck at home. And we don't know how long we are going to be stuck at home. That follows some of the news that came out this week from California and New York. It seems like the whole world is going into some sort of a shutdown phase and economies are grinding to a halt. The theme of this first hour is going to be the theory and strategy of moving towards cash, a cash portfolio, selling stocks, trying to get away from this general fear-based market and world that we are living in right now. I'm going to take a look at this move to cash from a couple different angles. I'm starting off this show with Mark Chandler, managing partner at Bannockburn Global Forex. Now, Mark, let's look at this move to cash when it comes to the currency markets and this spike that we have seen in the U.S. dollar. I first want to get your comments on what the Fed has done over the last week to try to stabilize some of these currency markets. Please share with us your recap of Fed policies and what their goals are behind them.
Yeah, sure. So we distinguish two things about Fed policy, right? One is the kind of like the QE and the assets they're buying in the U.S. Those are really aimed domestically. What I want to talk about is the currency swaps that they've offered foreign central banks. During the great financial crisis, these swap lines were in place on a temporary basis with many central banks. And it seemed to work. There was counterparty risk. Markets didn't want to lend to foreign banks. That is, U.S. banks didn't want to lend to foreign entities. And so the central bank stepped in there. The Federal Reserve made dollars available to, say, like the European Central Bank or the Bank of Canada. And then those central banks would auction them off to their members. And so that's how partly, I would say, an underappreciated element that helped us get out of the great financial crisis. So about a week ago, last Sunday, before the markets opened in Asia, the Federal Reserve announced that those swap lines with five central banks were permanent, and that they were going to change it to make it more useful. And what they did was previously, the banks who eventually borrowed it, the U.S. would charge 50 basis points on top of effectively Fed funds rate. And what they did last week is they cut that to 25 basis point premium only. And they also offered, instead of just one week swap, they offered an 84-day, or roughly a three-month swap. The idea there is that why they offer the swap lines is because they see that other countries, other companies, the whole global financial system is basically, if you literally can pull away and look at the plumbing of it, that financial system really has the dollar as a key element. Not the way we think about usually with trade flows or central bank reserves, but in terms of funding operations, in terms of funding supply chains, in terms of funding hedge funds. It includes, think about the Japanese life insurance companies who buy the American collateralized loan obligations, those CLOs, but rather than take currency risk, they borrow dollars and then buy the CLOs. And so what happens then in this kind of world in which money is borrowed to make purchases, as those assets have to be sold off, this kind of painful market. As the asset is sold off, now they have to buy back the dollars they previously sold. That's the way of borrowing the dollar. They got to pay back those dollars that were borrowed. So right now, I think that the Federal Reserve, their first instinct is, well, this the problem is not one of the price of the dollar, but access to it. So let's see if these swap lines work. So we've had several swaps this week. Europe took down the most, but it hasn't necessarily relieved pressure in the spot market, where since those swaps were conducted, the the dollar has still strengthened. So the Federal Reserve took a second bite of the apple and offered swap lines to more central banks, including some emerging markets like Mexico, Brazil, and South Korea. And it's early to say because those auctions haven't worked, but even the signal, the announcement of them, hasn't given much traction. So just before the weekend, the Federal Reserve announced a third bite of the apple. And that was, instead of just offering these 1 week and this 84-day facility, the Federal Reserve also going to say that announced that they were going to auction these dollars or give these dollars to the foreign central banks on a daily basis on the key central banks. Like key, I don't want to insult anybody, but the four or five major central banks they had permanent lines with. Those central banks they can auction off dollars to their customer, to their member banks on a daily basis. And that still does not appear. That announcement still, it helped cause the foreign currencies to bounce, the dollar to pull back a little bit, but it's not really sticking. And here's why. And this is, I think, gets us to really your point about this move to cash. I think that what's happening is people want dollars spot. As they get out of those funding positions, they want to be targeted a dollar obligation. It's not just transferring them, but it's really extinguishing them. So I think that it's important that the Federal Reserve does these steps. And it's kind of important. I think I've made this point on other time at the show, was that what the officials do is they climb an escalation ladder. And unlike us in the market and individually, they don't typically want to skip rungs in the ladder. So that's why the Federal Reserve took like three bites, or why the federal government in the U.S. has issued, I think we're working on our third fiscal package. Many countries have announced more than one fiscal package in the past couple of weeks. And so they're gradually climbing like an escalation ladder. And so if the swaps don't work to help ease the distortions in the markets, this demand for cash, then I think they'll have to gradually move, or they will gradually move towards thinking about actual intervention. And you know, the last two big dollar rallies we've had, that is Reagan dollar rally in the first half of the 80s and the Clinton-Rubin dollar rally in the second half of the 90s, both of them ended with coordinated intervention. Now, I'm not saying that it's around the corner. I'm saying that the bar is still kind of high for it. Countries are still resisting it. And sort of like what that quote from like Winston Churchill said about Americans, they're so claimed that you can count on Americans to do the right thing after they've exhausted the alternatives. And I think that's what we're doing now, is where we policymakers broadly are exhausting the possible alternatives. And as they exhaust the alternatives, they climb higher on that escalation ladder. But the drive here is not buying the dollar to go long because you're worried about it as a safe haven. So there might be some element of that. What I'm suggesting about the funding is that what's really going on is a big short covering rally in the dollar. People have used the dollar as a funding currency, are in essence short the dollar, and they have to buy it back.
All right. Interesting comments there, Mark. And to your point of a coordinated response, hey, we've already seen 14 central banks cut rates, and the largest central banks out there are pretty aggressively buying assets. One thing that has been on my mind is, as long as this economic shutdown is underway, yes, governments are making available cheap loans, they're freeing up cash to help keep small businesses, individuals, and even these large businesses that are coming for some pretty major bailouts. They're using the excuse that freeing up this cash will at least keep these businesses around. But on the back end of this, whenever we do finally get markets opened up again, companies are going to be burdened with debt, even if it is at 0%. That's still going to be a large line item on their balance sheet. How important or significant do you think this could be to the overall economy when we finally come out of this?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I think there are people who are, of course, you have to think about what's it going to look like on the other side, and how far is that other side away? You know, I do think that this is going to leave like big scars on like balance sheets, government balance sheets, household balance sheets, and therefore businesses. But I think that that's a second order problem. I think that the first order is that there is a economic crunch coming to us. You know, economists are often criticized for being unable to forecast a recession. And this recession that's coming is not here yet. It might have begun, but we don't really see much evidence yet in the economic data. And that I think that this is forcing us to go on like a war footing, combating a virus, going on a war footing. And so that means that during the World War II, for example, the U.S. budget deficit got to be about 25% of GDP. I'm not saying we're headed that way again, but the idea is that in this kind of crisis, I think that a lot of red lines, a lot of prior assumptions, prior ideas about what's right and wrong even, I think that they go out the window, and I think at the end of the day, we all become very pragmatic. And so I think it's important that we distinguish between two problems that we used to talk about during the great financial crisis, and that is a liquidity issue versus solvency issue. And the idea is to regard things as a liquidity issue for as long as you can. And that is to make sure that the circuit of capital continues to turn. So the central bank makes sure that banks have plenty of capital that they can lend on favorable terms. And then I think we'll have to see what happens on the other side. Yes, there'll be more debt. I think that, you know, coming back from recession, there's going to be some businesses that just cannot survive. A lot of the small and medium-sized businesses will struggle. And I think that as we think about the new world, I think it'll be more leveraged. But I think there's also some other good things that come out of it, better like medical infrastructure. You know, we talk about this many people talk about it as a black swan, but this is like the third or fourth such coronavirus. You think about MERS and SARS and Ebola and so we need to have, so I think we're going to come out of this in a much, I mean, it's unprecedented, but I think we're going to come out of this a stronger and more resilient.
Well, I hope you're right, Mark, but hey, we just have no idea, first of all, how this is all going to play out and how long we are all going to be stuck in some form of isolation, and then how that does actually carry over to the economies domestically and internationally, because they are really getting crushed right now. And I know small businesses, individuals, and even these large businesses are struggling quite a bit. We're going to wrap it up here, Mark. Good chatting with you. Some interesting insights on these currency markets. Everybody stick around. As I mentioned, we're going to be sticking with this theme of race to cash. But why is that race happening? Mark, thanks for your time. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks. Good luck, everybody. Stay well.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed the first conversation with Mark Chandler. I am now chatting with Mike Larson. He writes the Safe Money Report over at Weiss Research. Now, Mike, you know what? This is a crazy time in these markets. There's no doubt about that. But the theme of this show this weekend is this move to cash or race to cash because of all the fears in the market. We saw the US dollar spike to almost 103 on the dollar index, pulled back a little bit at the tail end of the week. But on top of the move by the dollar, we also saw the VIX close one day this week, early on this week, at an all-time high level. And we've also seen volatility just creep into, well, every market. We hit circuit breakers, what, three or four times just this week? It was insane. What is your whole take from this move that we have seen in this race to cash type of environment?
Sure. You're absolutely right, Corey. The kind of action here, I mean, I was trying to kind of dimensionalize it for someone earlier, and I was explaining it as a combination of the first couple of days after the 9/11 attacks where markets were trying to get back on their feet, plus what was happening in the great financial crisis in October 2008, and something more even beyond that. You know, every financial crisis, every crisis is unique. This one is probably unlike anything most investors, if not all, have really seen in their professional careers. And what we're seeing in the equity markets is clearly stunning. I mean, we had a 3,000-point drop in the Dow, second worst one-day decline outside of Black Monday in 1987. But as a guy who follows the credit markets very closely, I think what's happening there, it's less visible than, you know, the Dow Jones that's on the nightly news and so on to average investors, but it's even more significant. I mean, you're seeing dislocations in the credit market, municipal bond yields shooting up. So, you know, the cost of borrowing money as a city, state, school district, whatever is soaring. Commercial paper where corporations receive or obtain short-term loans just to kind of cover liquidity needs for, you know, a month or two or three. Interest rates on those short-term loans are skyrocketing. You're seeing the junk yields on junk bonds and junk bond prices. Yields are soaring, prices are tanking. I mean, we've seen the biggest one-week rise in the cost of getting money for a high-risk corporation ever. I mean, worse than in 2008. So all those things rolled into one, plus the soaring dollar, which is happening not for a good reason. It's happening because all these foreign banks and foreign investors are desperately trying to get their hands on U.S. dollars, so that's driving the cost up. All of this just speaks to the tremendous amount of stress in the credit markets. And that's why you're seeing, I mean, if you look behind the scenes, you know, it's bad enough when you see a stock like Boeing, which was, you know, 400 and something several months ago, and now it was less than $100, or, you know, all the airlines, hotel companies. I mean, there's huge declines there. But if you look at some of these non-bank lenders, these business development companies, or some of these REITs that are out there that make loans, that did a lot of the risky lending in this credit cycle versus a lot of the banks in the last credit cycle, these stocks are down 70%, you know, 80% in a week. It's stunning. And that just, again, that shows that behind the scenes, behind the Dow and the S&P, the stress in the system is enormous. And it's a combination of two things. Obviously, the acute catalyst is the virus outbreak, what it means for everything from consumer spending to travel spending to business spending, to the income being shut down. I mean, you know, I feel so bad for these people that work at living in Florida, for example. I mean, the tourism industry here, the restaurant industry, bars, hotels, all of that. I mean, people are losing their jobs left and right. It's going to be a really, really bad situation for that part of the economy. So that's going to be an issue on the income side. But the other issue that really set us up for this is coming into this unforeseen black swan event, this virus outbreak, we were in a very fragile financial system. And that's because we've been, for years and years, encouraged by central banks here in the U.S. and overseas. We've been taking on enormous amounts of risk in the corporate debt market. Corporations have sold more debt than ever before, are the most heavily indebted and most heavily leveraged than they've ever been. It's almost exactly like what you saw mortgage borrowers doing in the early 2000s. So when something set off the mortgage crisis, interest rates going up and house prices peaking, the damage was extraordinary because people had so much risk in the system. This time around, you've had enormous corporate bond risk, enormous leverage and stupid lending and borrowing going on in the corporate arena. So again, I didn't foresee the catalyst for a sell-off there for this process. And of course, it's happening much faster because the virus is such a sort of a hard shutdown event for the economy. But there was always going to be a crisis that was going to come out of this. It was just most likely going to be a lot slower in terms of playing out in a plain vanilla recession scenario, whereas this is obviously much worse. So it's a very troubling time. It's very uncertain. The Fed and the fiscal authorities are trying to throw everything they can at this problem. So far, it hasn't had much of an impact. And that's understandable, just given the depth and severity of what's unfortunately probably coming at the U.S. economy right now.
Yeah, and that's the biggest fear, too, is that, you know what, central banks around the world, they've tried this coordinated attempt to throw money at this problem, and it's only led to more fear in the markets. But touching on your point regarding the shocks to the economy and also just how leveraged companies were, yes, governments right now are making funds available for individuals, for small businesses, and even some of the largest corporations are going to the governments asking for handouts. But we're going to be left with so much debt, so much more debt on the back end of this. I touched on it last segment with Mark Chandler, but what's your takeaway from the fact of the matter is we're going to come out of this situation, whenever it is, with even higher debt loads?
Well, sure. I mean, if you look in past economic expansion, so in this case, we had basically the longest economic expansion in the U.S. ever, even though it wasn't a very vigorous one. Growth never got up to 4%, 5% or so sustainably in GDP. It was more around 2% and change. But in any event, in any economic expansion, what typically happens is the larder is restocked, the arrow is refilled with quivers, whatever sort of metaphor you want to use. The Fed or other central banks in other countries raise interest rates significantly during the good times when the economy could handle it so that they'd be able to cut them to help offset the downturn. The federal government would see tax revenue come in dramatically, increase dramatically as you know, the economy grows faster. And that would help to reduce the debt and the deficits that, you know, with the budget, even in the late 1990s, the U.S. actually went into surplus. If you remember, we were talking about the U.S. potentially paying down too much debt, that the markets were worried about it. That was how good the economy was. But in this cycle, we didn't do that. We were running multi-hundred billion dollar budget deficits in the U.S. for years under both Democrat and Republican administrations coming out of the recession. We, you know, in the last year, we're at around a trillion plus. And that was when the economic times were good. The Fed never got interest rates out of the low 2% level. Heading into the last two downturns, they had 500, 600 basis points of cuts they could do to get in before interest rates hit zero. This time around, they had just over 200. So that's the real issue. And now all the, you know, we never sort of unwound any of the crisis era problems and crisis era interest rates and crisis era government spending when the crisis ended last time. So that's left us in much, you know, much worse shape. So the government, you know, again, if you're talking about in this case throwing a trillion or a trillion and a half and whatever the amount of spending is going to be thrown at individuals and businesses and so on to stabilize the economy, you know, that's all going to have to be borrowed money. And on the corporate side, again, corporate balance sheets were leveraged higher and higher during the expansion. You've got some of these companies like a Boeing and some of these airlines or hotel companies, you know, of course, it's not their fault that this came out of the blue. It's, you know, nobody could have foreseen this dramatic, huge economic impact coming from a black swan event. But that, all of that said, they didn't build up their reserves in good times. I think I saw the statistic that the average U.S. airline spent 96% of cash flow in the last half decade or decade on buying back their own stock. Boeing bought back something like $100 billion of shares when the times were good and just frittered that money away. And now they want $60 billion in U.S. bailouts. Now, again, could they have foreseen such an intense crisis? No. But could they have been a lot more prudent with their balance sheets during the good times and at least socked some money away, not built up debt so much, bought back so much stock? Absolutely. And that's going to create a problem here. You know, we want to throw money at this problem as a country to you know, take the burden off these companies and employees and so on and keep the economy as healthy as it can be in an extraordinary challenging time. But what about political reality? You know, when we headed into the TARP vote and the great financial crisis, Americans by and large had no experience with, you know, how things were going to go. So when they came begging for $700 billion in TARP money, it got voted in very quickly with very few restrictions and people didn't put up a big fuss. But what happened? No bankers went to prison. There were no perp walks. These, you know, companies just got bailed out and then they ended up, you know, the same CEOs in many cases stayed in business. And, you know, the shareholders and the executives made out very well, while average Americans got foreclosed on and thrown out on the street. So that it left a very bad taste in our mouths because of how Geithner, Bernanke and Paulson screwed it up last time. So now you've got this huge economic problem. You've got Congress in a position that they're in the administration trying to figure out how much money to use and to spend here. But Americans are saying, look, why should we give these companies a bunch of money if they're, you know, when they just frittered it all away on stock buybacks? Why should we agree to do these bailouts when the last time around we got screwed and the executives got to walk away with the golden parachute? So the political resistance to a bailout here is much stronger than it would have been had the last bailout situation been handled better. Again, it makes it so I guess my point being, from both a financial ability to bail out standpoint and a political willingness to bail out standpoint, it's a lot harder to get something done here than it would have been in the past. So it's a very tricky situation. You know, I mean, I'm not a policymaker. I'm not a health expert. I try not to talk about things I don't know enough about. but I do know markets. I do know how politics impacts markets. And I think all of this has to factor in as an investor, you know, into your decision on whether or not you want to be aggressively bottom fishing, trying to buy, you know, cheap stocks here, or whether you just want to hunker down, keep your cash in reserve and wait for better times and better prices. And frankly, I'm pretty much in the latter camp. I don't think we've seen the worst of this. You go back to past bear markets, past downturns, the time for really aggressive buying is when assets are cheap, when sentiment is rock bottom, and plus when most of the worst of the bad news is out there and things are starting to get less bad. They don't have to be great. The news doesn't have to be great, but you can buy stocks aggressively when the news is just getting a little less bad and things are already very cheap. But I don't think that's where we're at now. We're just starting, unfortunately, to see the real economic fallout that the markets have already picked up on. And so I think it's just too early.
Yeah, fair enough. And hey, to your point regarding these potential bailouts, I think it was the United Airlines CEO just a few years ago that said he never sees the company losing money ever again. And that's why they just kept buying back shares. And hey, sure enough, they're going to the government for some sort of a handout. Let's wrap it up with an investment angle here. As I mentioned, you do write the Safe Money Report. What do you think of safe haven assets outside of the US dollar? Are these viable now, or is it still the market where too much fear and too much bad news could be around the corner? They get washed out with everything else if there is more downside here.
Sure. Well, yeah, we've been talking for the last couple of years, and I've been stressing that in this late cycle environment, before any of this virus stuff happened, you wanted to be in boring stuff, utilities, REITs, consumer staples, anything with yield, stability, recession resistance in terms of their business model. And that worked phenomenally well. Many of the positions in Safe Money Report that were in sectors like utilities did great. Coming into this year, and especially as the first signs of this turmoil came in, I was aggressively dialing down the portfolio, liquidating at big gains, a couple, you know, one or two nasty losses, but mostly big gains, and just, you know, raising cash, dialing things up, because I really think, you know, I was really expecting this situation to get worse, especially with what I was seeing in the credit markets. So mostly we headed into this pretty well. We actually were taking profits when the markets were starting to fall. We have a couple positions that got hammered, and that's just how it is. But we're also hedged against downside. Right now I have an inverse ETF in there. I have some a physical gold and physical silver position, and a ton of cash. And that's essentially, and maybe one or two stocks in conservative sectors. And that's about it. I think that kind of positioning, you know, it's not 100% perfect, but it's probably as good as things are going to get in this market environment. And I'm sitting on my hands. I think that, you know, and you want to be hedged. You want to have a lot of cash. If you're going to be in stocks, consumer staples type things, stuff like that could still work. But, you know, we have to steel ourselves against a potentially serious economic downturn. I mean, I saw one estimate come out. We could have next week 2 million jobless claims filing in this country. I mean, in the worst of the great financial crisis, I think the highest 1 week total was like 600 and something thousand. I mean, this is stunning. And again, it's just starting to happen. So that's why I think you just need to be defensive. You need to understand this is a truly unprecedented situation. And it came and it struck a market that was already priced for perfection with extremely overvalued assets, extreme risk taking in many parts of the debt market. And that means that, you know, even if we get past this sort of acute virus related fear phase, which I know we will as a country, we will get through this. Once we get past that, we still have to deal with the fact that we're underlying imbalances, assets were still expensive, and the economy was probably facing a recession in 2020 anyway. All of that argues for playing defense. And, you know, it may be boring, but you know what? Boring's a lot better than some of the alternatives.
Yes, it is. You're not going to get any arguments from me on that one. But we're going to wrap it up here. Mike, great chatting with you. Some very interesting times in these markets, which I think we're both assuming to continue here for at least the foreseeable near-term future. There's no end date on when these shutdowns and really economic handcuffs are going to come off. So I guess that just leaves us to, I think, build up a nice cash position and try to keep a level-headed approach to everything. All right, Mike, great
Absolutely.
Chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time on this weekend. Have a good weekend, my friend.
Thank you. You too.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.
All right, welcome back. Here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody has enjoyed the three segments prior to this one, and kind of continuing on that trend of this general race to cash, I am chatting with Jordan Roiburn, founder and editor of The Daily Gold. Now, Jordan, you and I were chatting off mic, and you were mentioning some research that you were doing regarding the crash that we are currently arguably in the middle of for stocks, just not just in the US, but globally, and technically stocks across the board. Doesn't even matter what asset you're in. Stocks are continuing to head down. You're comparing the crash to 1929. Can you please share some of this analog that you are playing off of or trading off of right now?
Well, I'm just looking at the research that other people have done following the two together. What happened in 1929 and that 29 to 32 historic bear was, I mean, you had three legs. You had a first leg down that was really sharp, which I think was about 2 months. And then you actually had a pretty good 50% retracement. And that lasted, I'm looking at it now, maybe 5+ months or so. And then you kind of had the water torture down third phase. So we're in the first phase where for the S&P right now to match what the stock market did in 1929, it'd have to go down to 2135. I don't know where it closed, but it's getting a lot closer. I don't know if we made a low tick today compared to a couple days ago, but a couple days ago on the low tick, I believe we were about 5 or 6% away from that point. So in recent days, I've been thinking the stock market is going to rally. Of course, it's struggled. It hasn't quite happened yet. You know, even after yesterday, we had a couple hammers the last 2 days. It looked like we were bottoming. Then we got another huge sell-off today. So I still think the next big move is likely to be higher rather than lower. But we can't rule out more selling, you know, in the next couple of days. But if we get that, you know, that's likely going to lead to a V-shaped rebound.
Now, how strong would you see this rebound going? And would it take us back anywhere near those highs of just a couple months ago? Or is that kind of a far-fetched idea now?
Yeah, that's a far-fetched idea. Well, we'd have to look at the retracements. And you probably look at the 38% and 50% retracement. So if it goes down there to, we'll just do 2,200 to make it easy on me while I'm looking at this. So that, I mean, a 600-point rally, we get up to about 2,800, but I don't think it's, you know, looking at, you know, I don't know where the 38% retracement would be, but just looking at the price action, I would probably guess you could see a counter trend rally, maybe 2,700, you know, 2,650, somewhere in that area could be a target for a rebound.
All right. Now, Jordan, one general question is just how long this could all go on for. Nobody knows how long this could go on for. But relating back to 1929, any thoughts on time frame in terms of how long investors will be stuck in the weeds?
Excellent question. Well, I am not a medical professional or epidemiologist. I don't know if that's the right term or word, but a lot is going to depend on that. And I think that, you know, to be conservative, how long could this last? It could be 18 months because you're going to get a vaccine probably by fall 21. Obviously, we will make improvements by then and probably be able to slow it down by then. But in that scenario, let's say that, you know, we're ready to completely recover by fall of 21. So maybe the market sniffs that out beforehand and bottoms, who knows, in the spring maybe. So, I mean, I'm just thinking off the top of my head. So potentially you could have a bear market of another 12 to 15 months. What does that mean for our sector? Well, I think gold would definitely bottom before. So if it plays out that long, then you can see a bottom in gold Q4 this year. But we'll have to see, Corey. A lot is going to depend on, number one, how fast can we get this under control? And then secondly, how fast can the government, you know, reliquidate everybody so that we can have a fast recovery. And so those, I mean, it's hard to predict, but the government's taken a lot of measures already, which are going to cushion the blow a little bit, but we're going to need to see some historic helicopter drops. And I mean, they might have to ramp these up big time to really contain the damage that could be coming.
Yeah, we're definitely going down that road. Governments, central banks are already starting to do almost everything they can, but hey, they can add a bunch of zeros to almost everything that they are doing. Let's move over to the precious metals, because again, precious metals have a bit of a headwind. They're remaining very volatile. But one thing that really stands out to me is, again, this massive discrepancy between gold and silver. Silver just took a beating this week. It dropped for a little bit of the week below $12 an ounce. It recovered a bit at the end of the week, but still we're sitting, what, $12.40, $12.50. That's a very depressed silver price. And gold, as much as it tried to move above 1500, closing the week below 1500, about 1840 or about 1490, maybe even a little bit lower than there. Let's start with silver. What are your thoughts on this crashing silver price?
Well, unfortunately, silver broke below the 2016 low and then the late 2018 low. If you can draw a trend line from those lows, and it comes into play right about $14 or so, if you're using, again, like a four-year trend line. So, and silver, of course, just blew right through that. I mean, I don't know, what is it trading at? A 10-year low, a 12-year, I mean, something like that. So with that, I mean, you had a complete technical breakdown in silver, which is really unfortunate. On the fundamental side, Corey, and I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago, silver is going to outperform gold in an environment where you have rising inflation and rising inflation expectations, and not the environment where there's economic weakness and we're cutting interest rates and that's better for gold and large gold producers. So we haven't been in the fundamental environment that, relatively speaking, favors silver. You know, given how we're probably going to recover, you know, how the sector is going to recover from this bear market correction, crash, whatever you want to call it, you know, gold is probably likely to turn first. And then when there's some stabilization in the economy, and then inflation expectations start to rise, that's when you'll see silver recover. But obviously, Corey, it depends a lot on the timing. You know, how long is it going to take to get there? And what worries me for silver is, you know, the downside target could be around 10 or in the mid nines. And I don't know how long this bear market is going to play out, but it could be really rough for silver stocks. I mean, some of these large producers that have debt, I mean, they're going to be in real trouble if this thing drags on. So silver is not looking that good, you know, both technically and from a fundamental standpoint. Now, at some point, you know, is it 6 months from now, 12 months from now, 9 months? I don't know. But at some point when we can see the other side of this, silver is going to be an incredible, amazing buy.
But we are not there yet. And hey, you still need to be very worried about a lot of these companies, not just metals companies, but we'll get into that a little bit later. Let's also update the COT reports for gold. You and I were looking at them quickly before we started recording this, because we are recording it after the market is closed on Friday. We're both surprised that the COT reports haven't shown, let's say, drastic pullback in the spec long position. What do you have to say about that? What are your thoughts? Update us on the COT reports as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm going to also, you know, in my updates, I'm also going to start looking at open interest and kind of compare it to what happened in 2008. But, you know, if we're just looking at nominally, I have one chart where it looks like the net spec position in gold about a month ago, it got as high as 380 or 385,000 contracts. And after the last report, as of Tuesday, it's down to about 300,000. That's when the gold price, I believe, was about 1525. I'd have to double check that again. But Corey, I'm just, you know, and I measure it as a percentage, and the percentage is still about 50%. I mean, open interest is coming down aggressively, which is good, but you know, it just tells me that there's still too many specs in the market. I guess, you know, we have seen a short-term floor around 1450. And so perhaps, you know, the bounce there multiple times this week, perhaps that has kept a lot of these spec longs in the market. And, you know, perhaps we really need to break below that to see this net spec position decrease dramatically. But that's kind of scary thinking about, you know, three, we came down to 1450 or we closed at 1525 and the net spec position is still 300,000 contracts like that. I mean, there's still a lot of liquidating that has to be done there. So, I mean, that's just not a good sign for gold and the sector as a whole. I mean, even silver, we've seen improvement there, but gold is really the one to watch because gold's probably going to bottom first. And, you know, there's more selling from specs that we're going to have to see. And so, you know, as a gold bug, it pains me, but the gold price is more likely to go lower than higher.
Hey, man, it's a tough market. But when we drive down into some of these juniors as well, you even mentioned some of the silver companies that are carrying a lot of debt, could be in for a lot of trouble. But what about these junior companies? I actually chatted earlier this week with John Kaiser, and he's been on record for years now saying that there are too many zombie companies, which are essentially companies that don't have enough going for it, and they need to almost exit the market, get blown away because, well, they cloud the overall market and investors' perceptions of these markets. Do you think that we're in for a general washout in terms of the overall number of stocks when it comes to juniors in the precious metals?
We really could be. If you think about it, if you go back to, you know, how long this thing could last, and then I had one thought that, you know, maybe gold bottoms in Q4, assuming gold bottoms before silver, and we know that the junior sector, if you look at GDXJ, GDXJ and silver, they tend to, I don't want to say they're 100% correlated, but they do kind of track each other to some degree. And so if gold bottoms in Q4 of this year, but it takes, you know, another several months after that for silver and the juniors to really get going, for inflation expectations to come back, then you could be looking at, I mean, what month are we in? March? I mean, you could be looking at another 12 months that juniors have to survive. And I think that, you know, Corey, even like, let's say we get a really good recovery that's similar to 2008 and we get a really good snapback, you know, at some point early or mid next year. I don't know that that is going to help all of the juniors. I mean, the juniors that, you know, their lifestyle juniors or whatever you want to call them, you know, they've been hoping, you know, me as well, that we would get this huge breakout in GDX and GDXJ, and we'd be in this huge bull market move, you know, for the next 18 months. You know, that's off the table for now. And so without that, without sentiment getting, you know, really, really bullish and speculation increasing in the sector, I think a lot of those companies, yeah, they're going to zero or they're going to flatline for a while. And I guess, you know, I got off track, but I guess what I was thinking was, even if we do see a really good recovery in our sector, I think a lot of these companies that don't really have anything, like, they're still going to flatline even when we get that recovery. And so, you know, we really could see a good clean out in the sector where, you know, you see, you know, intermediates or larger established juniors, you know, their stock prices come down to $2, $3, $4. And those are incredible buys. And then you see, you know, juniors with really good properties that are a little more advanced, you know, those things come down. And then, you know, exploration companies with really good projects that haven't really done much. I mean, those are the stocks that you could see come back to like 5 or 10 cents. You know, stocks that were, you know, maybe a year or two ago, they were $1, $0.50, $0.30. So I think it's looking like we have a chance to get to that type of a market where the stocks that are, again, that are at 5 or 10 cents, like, they're companies that have really excellent projects and strong fundamentals. And whereas all the other juniors that don't, you know, they've taken advantage of the strong market, they don't really have that good of a project. Those are the companies that could go to zero and go away. And it would be a good thing for our sector because, you know, the money could only then go into really quality companies, you know, supply and demand, fewer supply of companies, those companies will do better. So in the long run, it could be a good thing, you know, unless you're invested in some of those companies that could go to zero.
Well, and that's why it's important to have some cash too, because if some of these better stocks drop down to still fractions of where they're at, then hey, yes, you can make a lot of money, but boy, oh boy, it is, it's not an easy market out there right now, and that's the main takeaway from first hour of this weekend show. Jordan, great chatting with you. Thanks for taking some time today. I hope you have a good weekend. We will continue our discussions. Hopefully, we will see a turn, but it looks like it might still be a little ways off. Thanks for your time, Jordan.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.